This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Hi, good to be back.
So, let's get into it.
Okay.
I wanted to start by asking about a quote from the beginning of the film where you mm-hmm. quote, you have a quote from a Clarice Lispector book called The Hour of the Star. Mm-hmm. And the quote I wanted to pull out was, before prehistory, there was the prehistory of prehistory. So already at the beginning, you're asking us to think in a scale of time a lot bigger than what we're usually thinking about. So how did you come to want to translate that idea cinematically?
Well, I guess that coming to think about the translation came later. I was more grappling with how do we start thinking outside of human timescales. And it is why, even though you brought up Lispector, it was the Marcia Bjornerud writings, like she has a text called Reading the Rocks and one called Timefulness. And her, she coined this term polytemporality that really resonated with me, and which is basically an invitation to try to think outside of anthropic timescales. And so that was the first interest, not in the service of making a film, but just in the service of how to think ecologically and politically today. It seemed like it would be a good idea if we could think outside of our human time frame. So that was what was first interesting me. And then just because I am a filmmaker, the idea of trying to pull some of those questions into a film came into being. But I don't know, I'm not totally convinced that film is the best medium for quote unquote thinking polytemporally. I mean, maybe I should have built a henge, you know, or something. Maybe I should have done some petroglyphs, you know, because it's so ephemeral. I mean, film, as we know, has barely been around 100 years. It's certainly not, you know, it doesn't have longevity behind it. But what it does have behind it is an interest in forms of narrative, like forms of storytelling. And that is a kind of habit of form that was really interesting to me. You know, coincidentally, because I'm a filmmaker, but just thinking maybe genetically or in terms of how we pass down habits of knowledge or, you know, yeah, things that we've picked up along the way, you know, things that we've come to learn or that have been revelations to us. And it seems like so often the way that our discoveries do get passed down are monumentalized through a kind of story, through a kind of like habit of, I think of it as vibrational habit, but I mean, that's thinking in a really rhythmic or musical way. But to me, they're kind of cousins of one another, like story habits of sort of embedding information into a tale or into a myth or into something that gets repeated. Is a cousin to me of a kind of like, you know how a lot of times if you're having trouble remembering something, but then you hear a melody that will unlock. I mean, even people with Alzheimer's, a lot of times they'll forget many things, but when they hear a melody or they'll hear this kind of habit of rhythm, it unlocks things for us. So I think there's something to trying to find a pattern, a temporal pattern or a vibrational habit that can unlock times. My hope was outside of, you know, a life scale or a lifespan or even like a few generations. So, but it's not like I started making the film thinking like, I want to make a film that like outlasts X number of generations. It just, that's the, it's the form of media making that's endemic to me. So I gravitate towards cinema because that feels like an Indigenous language for me, and so that's what I feel comfortable speaking.
Let's talk a little bit about your process and just like how this mm-hmm. film, you know, took shape and formed. So in the past, you've described your process as quote unquote thrift shop filmmaking. yeah. I'm wondering if you can describe a little bit of what that is and just, you know, how this idea came to you.
Yeah. Yes, thrift store filmmaking is, it's because I think I'm not a script writer. I don't pre-write out ideas and then allow the film to illustrate them. I tend to make the films through the editing and or make the films by what it is in the world that captures me. In other words, working towards not, I mean, I am a filmmaker, so I capture things. That's part of the art form, but when are the times that I'm captured by something? And to try to pay attention to that. So when I go to the thrift store, I don't go to the thrift store like, I want to get a pair of blue pants with yellow zippers. No, you'll never find a pair of blue pants with yellow zippers if that's what you go looking for. Because at the thrift store, at least my experience at the thrift store, is you don't know what you want when you go in, but you see, when you see a good thing, you're like, ooh, look at those blue pants with the zippers. I know that's what I want. So I feel like that's my approach sometimes to filmmaking, where I don't necessarily know what I want, or I don't go into a situation with a pre-scripted idea of what it is I should be trying to get. But when I experience it, or when I see it, I happen to have the camera with me, then I capture it because I know it's right for the form. I mean, that's not, you know, every single film in the image. There's definitely, sorry, every single image in the film, there's definitely scenes that I specifically pilgrimage to get that thing. But a lot of the time, that's not the case. A lot of the time, I just try to go and be open to what presents itself to me and then try to be abducted by the moment.
Great. So this film has a lot of excerpts that are mainly grounded by these two voiceovers. Mm-hmm. One is from Marsha Bjornared, who is a geologist and a professor, and the other one is from Val Masadian, who's mm-hmm. another filmmaker. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could just talk about those excerpts and, you know, where they come from and what ideas grabbed you and how they made it into the film.
Yeah. I realize I didn't totally answer your question about the Clarice Lispector, but the film is a very literary one in the sense that before it became a film, it was a lot of index cards with little passages from books I had read that were very resonant for me. And the J.H. Rosny was one of them. Clarice Lispector was one of them. And Marsha Bjornared's text from Reading the Rocks and Timefulness. And as I was amassing all these quotes, in the beginning, I thought the film was going to be more of a pure science fiction. And I had met Val, who's a filmmaker and also an actress, years before when I heard her present. She was showing one of her films called, I think it was Nana, that she was showing. And her voice just totally galvanized me. And I just sort of put it in my back pocket, like, well, if I ever need a voiceover, I'm going to ask Valerie Masadian. And so her voice appealed to me for the more, I'm going to call it oracular voice, or the voice which is speaking more metaphysically. She's the conjurer of the film. She has a much more, you know, a very kind of low and to me sort of seductive, magnetic voice. And so if any of you have ever seen La Jetée, I feel like she's my La Jetée narrator. Like she's able to kind of bring a world into being just by speaking it. And so she was someone who just came to mind as a voice I would want for the more science fiction passages or the more speculative passages. But in the process of researching the film, at some point I segued from, I want to make science fiction, to, no, what's interesting is to what happens if you put a science factual delivery right next door to a science fictional one. What are those two attitudes of telling, what happens? It's almost like tectonic plates or something next to one another. I mean, what happens at the interface? And is there one type of telling that we're more prone to paying attention to than the other that seduces us more? That so having the two voices in there were in part just an experiment for myself to see what happens to have more of a kind of a pedagogical, like someone who's in lecture mode, which in a number of the quotes that we hear from Marsha Bjornerud, she is literally lecturing. I did interviews with her, and then I asked if I could just start attending her class at Lawrence University in Wisconsin, which is called, the acronym is HELL, which is the History of Earth, Life, and something, something. And she goes over basically 4.5 billion years in a semester. And so the voiceover that you hear in the film is a mixture taken from the interviews that we did and just my recording some of the lecture sessions that I went to. And I guess this is a roundabout way of answering. It wasn't just what they were saying and putting science fiction next to science fact, but how much the way of telling is kind of embedded in the grain of the voice. Like, even if you didn't speak the language they're speaking, the way that Valerie speaks, the idiom that she's speaking in, the grain of her voice is very different than the sort of lecture modality of Marsha, and it literally changes how you pay attention, and that's an interesting friction, in my opinion. Also, just to sort of question, like, you know, why does data and certain types of accounting of the physical world have more authority, especially in the West? Not to discount that, but to question the forms of receiving knowledge and which get lionized and which not. Sort of answering your question.
Yeah.
You're looking slightly confused.
No, I want to use that to segue to talk about the soundtrack.
Mm.
Because these two voiceovers have such an affective quality.
Yeah.
Like you said, Val's voice is, the grain of her voice is very strong.
Yeah.
But the soundtrack in this film in general is very strong.
Mm.
I'm wondering, how did you go about developing the sounds and pairing those with these images that we see?
Well, it's sound is always a hard question for me to answer because it's more than half of a film for me. Sometimes I feel like I'm just making images for a soundtrack, but really what I spend my time constructing is a soundtrack. And that's because, well, for many reasons, but the fact that sound is so efficient at evoking space, it can't exist without space, and it actually conjures space. You can have something be extremely intimate with a soundtrack, like even inside your own body, all the way to, like, you know, a massive hall or something outdoors, and you can do it also cheaply with sound. So I like that you can pivot really quickly in evoking what kind of space you're in. Also, it's just, you know, the nature of how physiologically we as kind of like traditionally hearing and seeing people, if you're conventional, if you have a conventional body and you do see normally and I don't even want to say normally, but you see out of your eyes and you hear with your ears, those are the, you know, some of the doors that you have into your corpus, then sound is what puts you in space much. I mean, vision is always like over there in front of you, but sound, you're in it, you're in the middle of it. It's 360 degrees all around you. And when you're hearing something, it's now. It's happening now. There's not a sense ever that it was before or later, but it puts you in the present in a way that's very manipulative. And it's why we're so, I don't know if you guys are like me and you go to horror films and you end up doing this. That's me anyway. I'm like plugging my ears. I don't close my eyes, but I'm like, I can't be, you know, it's extremely subversive and very manipulative, which is why I love using it so much. So all that's to say, to preface by saying that like the way I construct sound for any film is methodically and super involved and takes different tracks depending on which film I'm working on. So sometimes I start with a sound idea, sometimes the sound doesn't come till later. In this one, it's a mixture of certain sounds that I just happen to hear that are like compositions by musicians that I know will work really well for a certain section. Like what's a good example? Like in the, there's kind of a taxonomic section where you see close-ups of minerals and there's a sound, a series of sounds on the track that are somewhat, almost like, not onomatopoetic, but it's like, like very animating, giving the rocks this sort of personality. And that's a composition by Nicholas Collins, who works with a trumpet, but it's been synthesized. And that sound appealed to me because it had the breath in it, and yet it was electronic. And a lot of the overall arc of the soundtrack is that it moves from more or less, not, you know, discounting the voice, but the score moves more or less from something very heavily electronic to very analog. Like by the end, you're hearing Brian Eno's composition for The Clock of the Long Now, which is the bell piece he made, which is a series of chime proposals he made for this clock that dings like once every 10,000 years or something. That's probably not right, but it dings very rarely, like once every 100 years or 1,000 years, and that's one of the chimes he proposed. And then the piece you hear after that is the Shape Note Choir. And, you know, at that point in the film, it's so interscalar, you know, everything's like either really, really small, diatom, or you don't know where you are spatially. You know, things are massive and things are tiny, but nothing's really local. There's not a lot of things that are scaled at human scale. And so to the analog sounds that you hear more towards the end, as well as the caipora percussion, kind of like bring you back to the now and bring you back to this body, which I think is both an emotional necessity and kind of a political necessity, so you don't feel just like, well, we're all screwed. What are we gonna do? I mean, that there's something about, like, yes, we are just this body, but no, we're not inert. You know, yes, there are actions to be taken and there's something for me, hopeful in this kind of this collective sound making of the choir and the drumming, and especially that we can produce sounds with our body is, I think, it's very physiologically affecting to hear things or to do things in sync with other people. Like they've done those tests where, If like I'd never met you before, and they just asked you and I to come up here on stage and start walking totally in sync with one another, that we'd start to have more empathy from one another. So there's something about producing sounds together in sync with one another, or doing actions together in sync with one another that that evokes a kind of empathy. And I mean, I certainly think one of the things the film proposes is that we have to have more empathy for the other, like not just other types of humans, but other species and other matter. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, when I saw this film the first time, I was really struck by, you know, along with the idea of polytemporality, the idea of mineral evolution.
Oh yeah.
And just the enormous kind of precarity that life has, and our interconnectedness with minerals and rocks. What do you think was, what do you think was the impetus for wanting to make a film that was so kind of empathetic toward, you know, inert matter?
It's not inert. That's the thing.
Right. Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a verb. Everyone thinks rocks are nouns, and it's like, no. They're totally verbs. They're changing. We just don't have the right sensory doors to perceive it, but they're totally changing. And they're books, and they have like crazy texts embedded within them because of all the changes they've been through. So part of it was that interest in just, you know, like you brought up the mineral evolution, and that is something I knew nothing about. I went to the Natural History Museum, Mineralsammlung, the mineral collection in Vienna, and they had up a Robert Hazen little display about, and I was like, minerals evolve? Wait, what? So maybe everybody here knows this, but in case you don't, you know, when the planet was formed, there was X number of minerals. I'm going to get this wrong, but let's say there was 10. There's probably more than that. Then those minerals came in contact with forces, pressures, atmospheric changes, like when the GOE happened, the great oxygenation event, when you know, chloroplasts came to be and they started like spewing out tons of oxygen. Well, all the anaerobic things, there was like a 95% extinction, like everything died. But the things that could breathe oxygen were like, it's good for us, it's time for us now. So also when the GOE happened, there was a huge like explosion of new kinds of minerals, thousands of new kinds of minerals. So minerals, it's not like we always had all the kinds of minerals we have now. So this was a total revelation to me. I know the geologists out here are like, you're describing it all wrong. But more or less, for a layperson, I hope I'm getting it sort of right. So this blew me away. It meant that, to my mind, that minerals have evolved in part because of changes in biotic life, and biotic life has needed minerals. You know, we biomineralize. We certainly, you know, maybe we wouldn't be here without minerals. So that there's this sort of symbiosis or a kind of allegiance to one another that was one of the core engines of the film. I totally forgot what you asked me now and how I got here. I'm so sorry. Oh my God. People.
Well, one of the other things.
You're very patient.
Yeah, right. <Thank you. laughs> One of the other things that I think is really interesting about this film is, you know, not only is it from the point of view of minerals, but also humans are decentered in a pretty big way. Mm. And I think one of the ways we see humans is through ruins. They're the ruins of Petra, for example, in the film. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask you, you know, in this context, thinking about how minerals have gone extinct, what is interesting to you about human ruins and, you know, the possibility of human extinction?
I guess part of the impetus for making the film, it's not that I was excited about our species becoming extinct, but just trying to get a, recognizing that we're in the sixth great extinction, and to try to pull back and think about that in the bigger context of all the extinctions, and to sort of, to decenter like the hubris maybe of which clouds our ability to see other cycles and other sort of patterns of, what could potentially evolve besides us. I mean, how ruins come to factor in that specifically, I guess one interesting thing about them to me is like a monument, or when I see the hinges, for, like the menhirs that are arranged in the film, you see Almunda's Cromlech, the one where there's the two blind people and their companion walking with them through. But those kind of ritual organization of rocks, or the giant temples at Petra for that matter, I mean, they're monuments to something, and maybe we don't know exactly what they were originally intended to communicate, but it's the case that they're still communicating. Like they're a kind of vibratory system that's still speaking outside of the time that they were originally built, even if we don't entirely know why they were originally built. So, and that's interesting to me, that like, I guess it goes back to what I was talking about before in the very beginning of like, is storytelling one of our, the more sort of natively human ways of kind of organizing a ritual of matter or something, or a habit of matter. I mean, also they're humbling to see, you know, it's a pilgrimage to see the, even the smaller rock houses, like the rock house in Portugal with the big windmills around it, or certainly to see, you know, you kind of laugh when it's like, here's the view of the signs around Petra, but then you see it and you're like, dang, okay, that really is, it's incredible. And I felt the same when I went to the Henge too, just that they're very moving to me, that that somebody who, I don't know, that others before have had that kind of obsession, that stubborn obsession to move something that heavy and like make it, just to make it. It's, I don't know, maybe it's just like artist to artist, or I'm not an architect or a mover of heavy things, generally speaking. I mean, I do move heavy things now and then, but yeah, as a testament to someone's stubborn passion.
I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about just the process of gathering all of these materials. We were talking before about how you put this film on 35 and rephotographed a lot of these things onto 16. Mm-hmm. Can you just walk through that process of like how you built it?
Yeah, sure. So what? So you guys were looking at a Blu-ray, not a 35 print, but it does exist as a 35 millimeter print. And I shot, I would say there's roughly three categories of gathering. So there's material that I have shot over the course of my adult life as a filmmaker that I shot without any intention in mind, but it just becomes part of a personal archive that I shot it because I'm like, well, that's amazing. It captured me, right? I wasn't going out thinking I wanted to capture it. And so I filmed it and then put it aside. So shots like Petra, for instance, or the breakdancers, the spray-painted planet with the flame. There's a number of examples, but they're just shots that part of my own personal archive that I shot at some point. And then there's a lot of material that's from archives, probably a third of the film. Some are from archives that I went in person to visit and labs. And in some of those cases, I would just shoot off of their video screen monitors, off at, like their electron microscope would have a video monitor next to it. Or in actually the case of the chondrites, their polarizing microscope has a C-mount, so I just screwed my Bolex onto the C-mount and just shot right through the microscope. But some of the archival material was digital and only, you know, was originally digital, like the black smokers you see at the end under sea, which are like creating new landforms and new biota that live there, like extremophiles. Those I found just by basically trolling the internet, because a lot of this film was made during COVID, so I'm like, well, let's go. Spending a lot of time looking at archives online, and if I found a shot, for instance, some of that material, I contacted the lab and I would ask, you know, like, hey, you have these nice shots of black and white smokers. Do you have any like just long extended shot with no cuts? And sometimes they would email them to me, and some just exist as archive, like the NASA footage just exists online for anyone to search, and you can just. So what I would do in those cases, I would set up my camera and I would film my monitor. So those were like refilmed onto 16, and then the last category, I would call it like the pilgrimage shots, like shots that, you know, I'm like, oh, I need a cave, so I'd go to a cave to film. I need more rock houses, and so I would go film those things. So it's like the basaltic towers, which is Devil's Post Pile in the Sierras here. There's a number of other examples where I was in the editing process, and at that point, there was a specific hole to fill, and I needed an image for it, so I would, in that case, I was just making a trip to go capture that thing. Then the actual writing process starts, which for me is where I make the film, is where I'm editing, and it's just like a mess of index cards, and I'm moving them around and cutting. And then at the end, in this case, I hadn't done this before, but I made a master that was digital, and then we printed to a 35 millimeter negative, and then from that I made the 35 prints. Voila, and that was the end of that. So, but we're not looking at that, but hopefully it still looked okay.
Do you feel like this film drastically diverged from your earlier work as being a pandemic film?
I guess I definitely spent more time in, reading before I made this film, and more time looking through archives than probably I have with any other film. There's a few exceptions that were kind of little commissions where I had to work with an archive, or that was the task, to work with someone else's footage or the footage from an archive. But yeah, this definitely, the COVID conditions had me in my studio. I mean, I was in the middle of making, still am in the middle of making another film that I've been shooting in Ethiopia, and that just totally ground to a halt, not just because of COVID, but also because of civil wars there. And now that's picking back up again, but this one, since I was already thinking about these themes, about deep time, as many, I guess, of you here are as well, and about polytemporality and about evolution and extinction, this film just seemed like, well, this is a good studio film, or at least I can be thinking about it and developing it more in my studio until such time that I can get out in the world again. But I think my films are, I don't know if I have one sort of style, like certain style. I think they're, I try to make for the film that's being born, and I try not to be, to just pull from styles that worked in the past. And I also just try to want to make something that is able to express itself more elegantly or eloquently than I can. Using sentences that hopefully the film itself, that's the whole idea. Like, it speaks for itself better than I can speak for it. Or that even you come to ideas that you couldn't come to if you were just reading or listening to sentences, that there's something that it's endemic to cinema, that somehow something that it's saying I wouldn't be able to say through writing.
I think we'll go ahead and turn it over to the audience for
thank
the
you for
Q&A.
Your questions.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming all the way out here and joining
us. No problem. Yeah.
Hello?
Oh. Hi.
Yeah, I was just real surprised. It was very scientific. I love science myself. What's your science background?
I'm a hobbyist, is what I would say. Very early on in my education, I was very obsessed with science, and would go to the, and when I was in high school, I went to the Fermilab Saturday morning physics program. I mean, I was really, really very, very enamored of the sciences, but maybe had a crisis of faith at some point, and came back to art because I felt like it was a roomier, more elastic place to ask questions from. Not that I don't value the sciences, I totally do, but I've never pursued any one science super long. I mean, it was a total pleasure. I've made other films that are pretty indentured to landscape and to geology, and I've always been impressed with the way geologists read the landscape and are able to sort of read texts in places and read very long times in places, but I don't have, I'm curious, but I have no science degrees of any kind. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, science is for everybody, right? Like the phenomenological world should be for everyone. And I think that's one of the problems with the sciences is that we get so tight about how discoveries and data and just the natural world is translated, that it's great, it works great for some heads, but some of us need geopoetry, maybe a little more geopoetry. So hopefully this is helping.
Thank you for the film. I was wondering, I noticed in the credits for the sound design, I believe, Johan Lerf, another great contemporary experimental filmmaker. And I was wondering how much of a role collaboration plays into your filmmaking.
Well, thanks for the shout out to Johan. Actually, Johan was the one who recognized, he was helping me shoot in Vienna, because early on, when I was shooting at the Natural History Museum there, it was so early on in the film that I didn't actually know if I was gonna make a video or a film. So we were shooting on both video and film, and he was shooting all the video material, which was great because I could use that sound. And he was the one who, when we were in the lab, who recognized that's a seamount on the microscope. But you're right, he's a great filmmaker. And one to check out if you don't know his work, L-U-R-F is how you spell his last name. Collaboration, I have a somewhat odd relation with collaboration, because while I do work with, every film is a collaboration with the world, really, I guess you could say. But I mean, I'm a bit unconventional in that I shoot a lot of my own material, I edit my own material, I do my own sound design, I'm my own director. I mean, I'm an artist who makes films, and it's slightly unusual for filmmakers. Normally, there's like a really robust team, and I have made films with crews. I think my biggest crew was about 14 when I made Hacked Circuit, which is a short film about Foley. And but I normally am more comfortable working pretty small, and because I can pivot more quickly, but also I think the real reason is I usually don't know what the hell I'm doing. And you have to really, if you're gonna bring a bunch of people in and collaborate, especially in production mode, there has to be something pretty clear that you know you're doing. So a lot of the times, because I don't find the film until after I've shot a lot of the material, it's not so conducive for working with big crews. But that said, I almost always have sound recordists with me, and I've worked with a lot of musicians over the years. As Alex was asking about before, I mean, sound is a huge part of my practice, and I have worked with other cinematographers before on a few other films. I've had co-shooters, but I think those are more the exception than the rule. And it's not that I'm anti-collaboration, it's more just like my own failings of being able to pre-game anything. I just am really bad at it. So I just kind of, grope around as I go.
The vision evolves with the film.
Yes. I mean, I make the film so I can start to articulate the questions, 100%. I don't know even what they are at the beginning sometimes. I just know generally this is the direction I'm going, but I make the film, if I knew, I wouldn't make it. I mean, I make the film so I can sort of learn along with it, yeah.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.